In the late 1970s, West German Chancellor Helmut Schmidt had grown increasingly concerned that the Americans were taking their eyes off the European ball. The US was preoccupied with covert wars against the Soviets in Africa, Central America, and Afghanistan. And they didn't seem overly concerned, at least to begin with, about the Soviet SS-20s pointed at Europe. Schmidt saw the deployment of Kruse and Pershing as a way of getting the Americans to recommit to the defence of Europe. But what Schmidt failed to see was that the new missiles changed the rules of engagement between the superpowers. Now the United States could fight a nuclear war in Europe by remote control, without a single missile being fired from the American mainland.
Actually, I think it increased the risk for the Europeans, and this aggravated the tension between the United States and Germany and other parts of Western Europe to quite some extent, and the Soviets tried to exploit it, and then the Germans indeed became very, very anxious, what the Americans call German angst, that the nuclear war might actually annihilate Germany and German territory.
In my opinion, these two weapons, Pershing and Kruse, are significant for the change in the nuclear strategies. In former time, nuclear weapons have been only available to prevent war, you know, effective deterrence with a revenge potential, and nobody could fire the first shot without the risk to be killed as a second. But with these new weapons, which are more accurate and more precise and with a very short fly and warning time, this makes a new situation for the European allies of the United States, I think. The entrance in a nuclear war is much more easier when such weapons are available.
General Gert Bastian talking to Harry Kreisler in the series Conversations with History.
The Soviets themselves, they did not see themselves as having developed their own SS-20s as a threatening weapon. They just did it because they could do it. They were in a position to build this sort of weapon, so they did it without really thinking that much of what the consequences might be.
Wojciech Mustny, coordinator of the Parallel History Project. The project is an ambitious attempt to tell the story of the Cold War from both sides of the Iron Curtain, using material from the Soviet and Eastern European archives and from declassified NATO sources.
And when the consequence was the Western decision to build the same sort of missiles to match the Soviet ones and checkmate their possible use, then the Soviets were surprised and annoyed and in fact threatened.
Well, the Soviets played this quite stupid propaganda game to use the peace movement against the Western alliance because they thought they could split Europe from the United States by actually supporting the peace movement and avoiding the deployment without having to make any Soviet concessions. Some people today make the argument that's what we knew all along, that it's basically they are Soviet dupes and it's all actually steered by the Soviet Union, but it's quite ridiculous. In quantitative terms, it was such a massive movement that this Soviet interests, which were expressed by very few people in the movement, really were not the most decisive one.
In early 1983, air raid sirens like these weren't an uncommon sound in West Germany. I used to hear them regularly at breakfast time in the sleepy university town where I was a student. Close by was a large American military base, and up in the woods behind the town, a key NATO communications centre. Well, like most of the locals, when I heard the sound, I'd just assume it was another exercise and go back to my coffee and the newspaper. The news from Geneva wasn't promising. The Soviets and the Americans were locked in arms negotiations. The Soviets were refusing to scrap their SS-20s, and NATO was preparing to deploy Kruse and Pershing in the autumn. Both sides were fighting a war of nerves on the battlefield of the imagination. Then, in early March, Ronald Reagan gave a speech at an evangelical convention in Florida.
Let us pray for the salvation of all of those who live in that totalitarian darkness. Pray they will discover the joy of knowing God. But until they do, let us be aware that while they preach the supremacy of the state, declare its omnipotence over individual man, and predict its eventual domination of all peoples on the earth, they are the focus of evil in the modern world.
The ideologically aggressive speeches by Reagan, the Secretary of State, Schultz, and other members of that Reagan administration frightened the Soviet government immensely, because they believed, for example, Nixon was not dangerous because he didn't make strong ideological attacks on the Soviet Union. That's why it was easy to sign agreements of all kinds with Nixon. But they were frightened by Reagan in the beginning. And that's why they took Reagan very, very seriously as an aggressive, potentially aggressive president who could unleash a nuclear war just because he had the idea of to destroy communism, the communist system.
Former KGB London chief Oleg Gordievsky. Just 3 weeks after Ronald Reagan had called the Soviet Union an evil empire, he gave another speech which frightened the Soviets even more.
What if free people could live secure in the knowledge that their security did not rest upon the threat of instant U.S. retaliation to deter a Soviet attack, that we could intercept and destroy strategic ballistic missiles before they reached our own soil or that of our allies? Let me share with you a vision of the future which offers hope. It is that we embark on a program to counter the awesome Soviet missile threat with measures that are defensive.
And then, of course, there came the Star Wars speech by Reagan, which introduced a new strategy.
Some say it will bring war to the heavens, but its purpose is to deter war in the heavens and on Earth.
And the Russians believed that it was possible for the United States to create that defense in the space against nuclear missiles in a relatively short time, like they prepared the flight to the moon, the landing on the moon, in a historically short time.
Now, that was interpreted by some on the Soviet side as an attempt to put the United States in the position of being able to carry out the first strike that would cripple the Soviet Union and thereby win a major war.
I paid a visit to Moscow in the summer of that year, and it's a time when Andropov was still theoretically General Secretary of the Communist Party, but was dying, and every Soviet official one met was running around like a chicken without a head, sometimes talking in conciliatory terms, and sometimes talking in the most ghastly and dire terms of real hot war, of fighting war, of nuclear war.
So that was summer of 1983?
Yes, yeah.
So they were really talking about it then when you were in Moscow?
Yes, yeah.
They believed that it was a real possibility.
Yes, and they were extremely frightened of some kind of large military exercise by NATO in the autumn of 83 after the Bundestag had approved the missile deployments.
The vote for deployment came after 26 hours of debate, 2 days of often impassioned and emotional argument, even though the result, given Chancellor Kohl's assured majority, was not in doubt. The decision is the signal for the United States to start moving the first batch of Pershing 2 missiles to West Germany. Reports in Bonn indicate that parts may be flown in as early as tomorrow.
I was sitting outside the Bundestag after the key debate at which the West German Parliament decided to accept the deployment of Pershing 2 missiles. I was sitting on a bench outside the Bundestag, and it occurred to me then that this was a historic event, that I could see the end of the Cold War unfolding before me. I wasn't sure who had won it, but I could see who had lost it. We had a loser, and that was the Soviet Union.
So, how does it end?
Richard, please don't.
The birds had started, which filled me with sadness. I mean, The missiles thing.
Oh, yes.
What about the Soviets, for God's sake?
What about the Soviets?
They could go to war.
Why would they do that? The war's been fought. They lost. This was their last shot. They've got nothing else except a rebellion in Afghanistan they can't put down and a population they can't feed.
Please, Polina.
As the Pershing 2 missiles were being flown into bases in West Germany, the Russians walked out of the arms talks in Geneva. Within days, NATO began a major military exercise codenamed Able Archer. Normally, such exercises would have been routine, but the build-up of tension during 1983 had now reached its crescendo, and Moscow's nerves were stretched to breaking point. Professor Paul Dibb, former director of the Joint Intelligence Organisation in Canberra and a specialist on the Soviet Union.
There was a fear in Moscow that the NATO exercise Able Archer in November 1983, which was an exercise which escalated from a conventional conflict with the Soviet Union in Europe to simulated nuclear release, that this exercise was being used, if you like, as a cover for an actual nuclear attack.
I've just had a call from General Guthrie in Rheindland to confirm to me, as a courtesy, that Rhine Army has successfully deployed on to launch on warning. Do you know what that means, Richard?
The simulation of release of the nuclear weapons entailed the use of encrypted codes. So we can assume that the Soviets are being unable to figure out what these codes have meant. Did not rule out the possibility that it might be the real thing.
And of course, keep in mind that this was a stage in the Cold War where there were hundreds of thousands of NATO and Warsaw Pact forces sort of lined up on both sides of the Iron Curtain, down the heart of Germany and down the heart of Central Europe.
It reminded me that the armed forces had not attempted, let alone completed, this manoeuvre since 1948, and never with nuclear weapons.
The Russians, because they were so upset and so nervous, the military people took it as a sign of the... Indeed, you see, they are preparing an attack on us.
The Soviets really thought World War III was about to happen.
The Soviets were reacting to hair trigger alert in reaction to the NATO exercise Able Archer.
I want to confirm, is this an exercise?
And the military commanders, including people sitting at the ready to launch a missile, a nuclear missile, they were very nervous. They were sitting there believing that it may be true. That's why it was so dangerous.
Roger, copy. This is not an exercise.
And to give you a dramatic example, the group of Soviet air forces, East Germany, was forward-loading tactical nuclear weapons onto Sukhoi 17 long-range strike aircraft to strike West Germany.
We are trying to contain the most dangerous crisis since the war.
They were tactical nuclear weapons to bomb military and other targets just across the border from East Germany in West Germany. Flight time, a few minutes.
Let us pray for the salvation of all of those who live in that totalitarian darkness. Pray they will discover the joy of knowing God. But until they do, let us be aware that while they preach the supremacy of the state, declare its omnipotence over individual man, and predict its eventual domination of all peoples on the earth, they are the focus of evil in the modern world.
Why, of all places, only Germany?
We know now, of course, that the Cold War ended not with a bang, but with the popping of champagne corks here at the Berlin Wall in 1989. But as today's story shows, it could have ended very differently. Raymond Gartoff experienced the other near catastrophe of the Cold War at first hand, as an advisor to President Kennedy during the Cuba crisis. Gartoff believes that the war scare of 1983 was scarcely less perilous.
It was a matter of rather, I would say, greater danger than almost any other period in the Cold War. If only because these most, shall we say, extreme or hardline elements in the Soviet intelligence and military leadership might have at some point either misconstrued some developments in the West or chosen to act on the basis of evaluations that were greatly exaggerated. And that's why I think there was such great danger involved.
The most comprehensive and carefully documented account of the 1983 war scare comes from the CIA. But the CIA declined our request for an interview with CIA historian Benjamin Fisher, who wrote it. However, you can find a link to his article and a whole wealth of information about our series on the Cold War on the Radio National website. Go to www.abc.net.au/rn and follow the prompts. Now, you may be wondering by now, if the Soviets really got that close to pressing the button during the Able Archer exercise in 1983, what was it that stopped them? Well, the ultimate answer to that question lies in the former Soviet military archives in Moscow, archives which are still closed both to Russian and to foreign researchers. But Wojciech Musny thinks we can draw a tentative conclusion from what we do know, from the archives of the former Warsaw Pact allies such as East Germany. The fact that Able Archer didn't end in nuclear holocaust is probably down to some anonymous KGB analysts in Moscow who decided that the evidence that NATO was about to launch a first strike just wasn't strong enough. In other words, it may be that the world was saved by middle management.
Well, now what was different during the Cuban Missile Crisis is that this was really managed by the top leadership. And in that instance, by Khrushchev in particular, who was a gambler. So that was what made the Cuban crisis so important and so dangerous. In 1983, we didn't get that far. We didn't get to the upper level. Either there wasn't time to pass it on to the leadership, or they decided that it was not worth it, or they attached qualifications to it, that it was not certain. In any case, one can assume that fortunately they used their common sense rather than being alarmist or panicking. So that, I think, is encouraging. What is disconcerting is that it may have been a close call. And maybe one crazy guy someplace along the line really could have created an enormous havoc.
If you look at the history of the Cold War, you should recognize that nuclear weapons are not controlled by statesmen. They're not controlled by states. They're controlled by military organizations and normal, frail, all too human military operators. It seems to me that our successful experience during the Cold War blinds us all too often to the dangers that existed at that time.
These were serious times. And you know, Tom, if I might just make a comment, that brings us back down to the current times when we have ministers in the current Howard government who I presume were in short trousers or diapers at the time, proclaiming that the war on terror is more dangerous than the period you and I are talking about. How can it be? The terrorists, as nasty as they are, and even if they get their hands on some chemical or biological or a limited nuclear capacity, they won't have the capacity with intercontinental ballistic missiles to deliver 12,000 strategic nuclear warheads and take out, and these were our calculations at the time, the total global deaths in the Soviet Union and its allies and in the United States and its allies, put into one side what the fallout would do to the rest of the world, would have been, in a full-scale nuclear war, 100 million on each side in something like a day or two. That really puts the war on terror into context. As serious as it is at the moment, it is not comparable.
But, I mean, isn't the argument that, in a sense, we had a situation for 45 years where the threat of mutually assured destruction prevented the use of nuclear weapons, and that we're now living in a situation where, because there is no longer that balancing of mutually assured destruction, the possibility of a nuclear weapon being used, for example, by a terrorist group has actually increased?
Yeah, look, I mean, there's truth in that. Even so, we will not be at full-scale nuclear war. And although mutual assured destruction worked, we've just been discussing, Tom, that the views on both sides now are we came precious close in 83 to the buttons being pressed.
I haven't got words for it. Nobody has. All I can think of is that shadow that was somehow burned into the steps of the Sumitomo Bank in Hiroshima. Something out of this world, beyond comprehension. Maybe it would come out differently, maybe even in their favour, or... Polina came up on her elbow. She said,
"Does the name Edmund Fisher mean anything to you?"
"He's a name to me, that's all."
"He was one of my professors at Georgetown. Ed used to say that the nuclear arms race, far from being the diabolical enterprise of popular imagination, is an appropriate, even benign form of competition between two great powers. He used to talk like that. The purpose of the Cold War is, I guess you should make that was, to save blood, not to spill it," he said. "Years from now, it will seem as quaint and harmless as the tournaments of medieval chivalry."
You've been listening to Hindsight on ABC Radio National, and the final episode of our special series, Torn Curtain, The Secret History of the Cold War. Dr. Bernd Schaefer was the historical consultant to the series. Technical production was by Judy Rapley. Original music was by Stuart Brown, and Michelle Rayner was the executive producer. Readings in today's program were by Mark Kilmurray, Rachel Salleh, James Carlton, Tony McGregor, and Andrei Shabunov. Torn Curtain was written and produced by me, Tom Morton. And thanks to everyone who helped to make the series happen, in particular the staff of Radio National Operations and the ABC Sound Archives and Reference Library.